Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and our show is Fight the Empire. And today we're going to kind of go back in a little bit of history. And my guest is Burton White, who is a labor mediator and lives in the Portland area. A respectable citizen, but 50 years ago, we were both arrested in San Francisco at the sort of infamous San Francisco City Hall. I call it the uprising. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit because, you know, a lot of our listeners weren't even born at that time. And so they don't know too much what it was all about. And it all had to do with the, first of all, Burton, welcome to KABU.
Well, thank you.
And first of all, let's talk a little bit about the House Un-American Activities Committee, because that was sort of the center of the whole thing. So tell us, what did the House Un-American Activities Committee do?
Well, mostly, let me start this way. Legislative committees have the role of doing investigation for legislative purposes,
mm-hmm.
and keeping a close watch on other branches of the government. So it's part of the
sort of the normal procedure,
the balance system that we have in our government. But the House Committee on Un-American Activities, its official name, mm-hmm. it was called HUAC because it was much easier to say. Basically, was the House of Representatives version of Joseph McCarthy,
mm-hmm.
and they were red hunters. By that I mean they would take anybody who dissented on the left side of the spectrum and did their best to find ways to punish them by exposing them. Perhaps I can give one example because it's has relevance to what happened to us in 1960. In 1959, the House Committee on Un-American Activities announced it was going to investigate education in California. It issued 110 subpoenas to public school teachers. Point number one, the subpoenas, or at least most of them, were issued to the teachers at their places of work, so that clearly their employers would know. And there was a great deal of civic protest, a wide spectrum of people and institutions in the Bay Area opposed that hearing, so finally it was canceled, but not before the committee gave its staff orders to distribute the dossiers on these 110 teachers to various school boards. So clearly, that example, I think, establishes what it really did, was to go after people they considered to be pinkos or leftists and get them out of work.
Mm-hmm. Well, earlier, they were sort of, weren't they behind the the hearings on Hollywood, the Hollywood 10, that was one of their, and actually before that, I believe back in the 30s, they had gone after Nazi sympathizers, you know, sort of in the years preceding World War II and beyond, but they very quickly switched to going after left-wing radicals.
Well, it was whatever group was unpopular at the particular time. excuse me. And you're right about that reference to the hunt into Hollywood. They had the view that people who had left-wing political opinions would sneak propaganda into their product.
Mm-hmm.
Let me digress for just a moment. There were, when people opposed the committee and called up as witnesses, they used one of two constitutional amendments as a basis for refusal to answer. The first was the First Amendment, And the Hollywood Ten, these are directors and writers from Hollywood, used the First Amendment. As a result of that, they were accused of contempt of Congress and were imprisoned after a trial. It then became clear that the only constitutional amendment that would protect a refusal to respond was the Fifth Amendment, the refusal to testify in a criminal case against oneself. And the phrase Fifth Amendment communist arrived out of that system. And as a product of that in behavior of the committee, both broadcasting and Hollywood developed blacklists were so that people would not be employed, at least not be employed under their real names.
So anyway, then they announced that they were coming to San Francisco, and they had subpoenaed a bunch of people. I guess Bill Mandel was one. He was a fairly well-known expert on the Soviet Union, one of the few who didn't go to work for the U.S. government. You know, he wasn't one of those Sovietologists. Although I guess he did work at the Hoover Institute for very briefly. And I remember another one was Archie Brown, who was a San Francisco longshoreman who was active in the union and who was, I believe he was very proud of being a communist. And there were other people. But there was organizing on the Berkeley campus, which you are familiar with. You were a student at UC Berkeley. And so tell us about the student organizations there. One was called Slate.
Yeah, let me back up a bit on that. There were various things happening in the tail end of the 50s that marked a change from the sort of the 1950s, where people were pretty much content to be as conformist as they possibly could be. There was a young man by the name of Fred Moore, the son of a Air Force colonel, who objected. He was a freshman at Cal Berkeley, and he objected to compulsory ROTC. So he went on a hunger strike on the steps of the administration building, Sproul Hall, and by his quiet dignity, he got a lot of respect from the students. So signal number one that something was changing on the campus. You mentioned Slate. The left-wing, liberal, progressive, whatever term applies, students were a little bit tired of having fraternity and sorority people always be the officers in student government. And so they formed an organization, Slate, to put up a slate of non-Greek candidates. And to everybody's astonishment, they won quite widely. As an aside, a large portion of their constituency were graduate students such as myself. So soon after that victory, the graduate students were removed from the student body, and they no longer could vote. All right. Fred Moore.
Who did that remove? Is that the administration?
The administration.
Oh, okay.
I came there in 59 as a graduate student in English, and I was able to vote in one election, and after that I was disenfranchised. Another thing that happened was that just a few months before, early in the 60s, the execution of Carol Chessman took place.
I was very big in the Bay Area. Remember that.
And he was executed for kidnapping and sexual abuse. It wasn't a murder charge on it. And so that the opposition to capital punishment joined up with people who felt that capital punishment should be reserved for murder. And there was a overnight vigil of substantial proportion. So all of these things were sort of indicating that there was a ferment going on, at least in Berkeley and the San Francisco mm-hmm. Bay Area.
Also, I think a lot of the students had just come back from organizing in the South, voter registration things there.
I think that happened a little bit later mm-hmm. because a couple months before May 1960, and this was a very important event that had impact upon what developed as the student movement, four African-American students sat in at a Woolworth's lunch counter at, I think it was in North Carolina, and refused to leave. They were not, of course, they were not served. Mm-hmm. They refused to leave and were physically and verbally abused, but just sat there with a quiet dignity. And were arrested, and they just kept coming back, sat in, were arrested. And that message of nonviolence, standing up for your rights, and doing it in the face of a great deal of physical and verbal and social mistreatment had a great impact upon a lot of people, myself included. Mm-hmm. The activity of working on the civil rights movement and going down came a little bit later. But those four students marked the beginning of the civil rights struggle. And I guess what we did at City Hall, we haven't quite touched that yet.
No, we'll get there pretty soon. Huh?
One other thing about the Bay Area climate is that Pacifica Radio, KPFA, the very first mm-hmm. Pacifica station, had been in existence for about 20 years at that time and had a great force in keeping the dissenting community united and active. And finally, one can't forget that in the San Francisco Bay Area, it was a great union town.
That's right.
And so all of these factors, I think, helped to combine to make the event that we participated in happen in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Fight the Empire. I am Per Fagrang, and my guest is Burton White. And both of us were arrested 50 years ago this month. Hard to believe that's so long ago. 50 years ago this month at what they call, they call the City Hall riots. I call the City Hall uprising in San Francisco. So let's talk about the May 13th, 1960. I was, you were one of the student leaders.
Well, I came to be. That's an interesting point. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And I was actually my last job. I'd been working as a cab driver for Yellow Cab, and I had recently quit my job. I couldn't stand the hours. But anyway, so we were there at City Hall. Now, City Hall in San Francisco is this big kind of looks like the Capitol in Washington, the dome and everything. And the hearing was held in the Board of Supervisors' chambers, which is on the second floor. So you come into this building, and there's this big kind of a grand staircase going up to the second floor, and then there's a kind of a rotunda up there, and then on the other side of the rotunda was the supervisors' chambers. And it was not a very large room. It was kind of, it was pretty small. And so the floors were marble. Keep that in mind. Marble floors. This is very important. We'll get to that.
So anyway. Marble staircase.
That's right. So we were all standing in line.
Well, let me take it back one day. Mm-hmm. It was a three-day hearing.
Mm-hmm.
The 12th, 13th, and 14th of May, 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And It was a public hearing, at least purported to be a
supposed
public
to be, hearing. Yes.
So a group of us, well, a group of people at the university, Students for Civil Liberties, a group that had been affiliated with the ACLU, Slate, we just got through describing it, and the Young People's Socialist League planned a picket line around City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
But others, and one other footnote, there was Berkeley student, an 18-year-old freshman who was subpoenaed for that hearing. So mm-hmm. that had additional interest for the campus. So the picket, the people who planned the picket had a rally and then were going to set up the picket line. Those of us who wanted to attend the hearing went there and found out that there were two groups. Those of us who were waiting in line and another group that got in first.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that the committee had announced a public hearing, but not announced to the public was that they gave out passes to friends of the committee, organizations such as the American Legion and the Daughters of the American Revolution,
mm-hmm.
because they wanted, quote, decent people in the hearing, close mm-hmm. quote. So that most of these card-carrying friends of the committee filled that relatively small hearing room. That group didn't get up early enough, they didn't fill the room, so some students got in on Thursday morning, fewer on Thursday afternoon. And so when that had occurred, a vocal protest started right outside the supervisors' chambers. Chants, open the doors, let us in. Mr. Willis, he was the chair of the subcommittee. Mr. Willis, we're still here. And some singing. And that was Thursday afternoon. Friday morning came, and there were more card-carrying friends of the committee who filled the room. Very few students got in. And so the vocal protests continued throughout the morning. Just before noon, the sheriff of San Francisco came out. And
that was Matthew Carberry, I remember.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And he really, I felt, did a very admirable job. He wanted to keep order within it's the city and county of San Francisco, so that the sheriff had authority there. He wanted to keep order within the building, but he also recognized the unfairness of the seating arrangement. And he, after a conversation with the protesting students, and that's where I took a leadership role, he went off to have lunch with the chair of the committee to try to talk them out of the preferential seating.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the lunch period, 12 to 1, there was no protest. At about 10 minutes past 1, when the doors were opened again, the white passes got in again. At that point, we misunderstood where the sheriff was. We thought that his prior conversation with us was a setup. And so a very, very disturbed and angry bunch of protesters began the vocal protest once again.
Well, I remember I was in line, kind of near the end of the line, and I'd heard that Sheriff Carberry was working to make sure that, it's kind of first come, first served. But lo and behold, this other line, they were kind of on the other side of the rotunda, and doors opened, and they got in first, and I think there was probably room for maybe one or two students after they got in.
A very small amount.
Yes, and then the students started singing and chanting, and then I remember somebody said, "Everybody sit down, everybody sit down." So I sat down with everybody else and just sitting there, And I looked around, and there on the other side, across the rotunda, were a couple cops, and they were holding a fire hose. And all of a sudden, I don't recall that there was any warning at all. They were holding this hose, and then the next thing I know, this big stream of water is spraying all over everybody. And, of course, very soon you were just really soaking wet. And, what can you do once you're soaking wet? you don't feel like, it just gets you angrier and angrier. And so then they started arresting people.
Well, by the way, I found out the suit I was wearing was wash and wear as a result of that.
Oh, okay.
But the process of arresting, first of all, there was no warning given.
Mm-hmm.
I'll come back to the substantiate that point in a moment. The reason for the sit-down was to show nonviolence, but the police, and by that time they had the motorcycle squad in, the police came and dragged us, still seated, down the marble stairs.
Right, and when that marble is wet, it's just like ice. So they're basically sliding people across the floor and kind of bumping them down the stairs.
And 64 were arrested.
Mm-hmm.
One was charged with a felony. The police report was that the, quote, riot started when one person, Robert Meissenbach, jumped over a barricade, took a policeman's billy club from him, and started beating the policeman over the head. This, according to the official police report, enraged the demonstrators who rushed the police and started attacking the police.
Mm-hmm.
63 of us who were up on misdemeanor charges, the charges were dismissed. Robert Meissenbach went to trial about a year later. He, by the way, was acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
And another important thing to mention is when the police testified, because now they were under oath and now there was evidence that established what really happened, the police testified in exact opposition to their own police reports.
Mm-hmm.
There had been nobody jumping the barricade. No police person had been attacked. No warning to disperse had been given. They just turned fire hoses on a group of seated demonstrators.
Right, and this is on the orders of this Captain Michael McGuire.
And, Inspector Michael McGuire. Don't promote him.
And I was one of the last people who got arrested. I remember a couple of policemen picked me up and kind of lugged me down the stairs. And as we were going down the stairs, a little old lady was screaming at me. And then they took me outside and they put me in one of these police wagons. And so I was sitting there, and this student next to me was from England. His name was Christopher Bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting there talking, Inspector McGuire and another cop got on board. They got on this kind of a rear running board. There's an open doorway to this wagon. And so McGuire and this other cop climbed on the rear running board. And McGuire heard that English accent, and he just got into a rage. He started screaming at this kid, stuff we can't say on the air. And
not even on KABU.
No, especially not on KABU. So, and then off we went to the old Hall of Justice, which was a kind of a real gloomy building in Chinatown, very evil-looking building. It's no longer there. It's been replaced by the Financial District, I guess. And so, we were booked, and I don't think I ever got put in the cell. I think they booked us, and then we were bailed out. Somebody was down there bailing us out.
Charlie Geary.
Oh, that's right. Now, he was a pretty well-known attorney. He later became the attorney for the Black Panther Party.
And he was one of the two attorneys in the Meissenbach case.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say a word about Maguire, because soon after the event, he retired from the police department on psychological reasons. Come to find out, he had been released from the Army on a psychological discharge. Now, this is the policeman who was in charge of the police force who behaved in the way that I described and that you described him. I might just add a few minutes. At that time, I was a student in Chaucer. I was going to working for my doctorate. After this, I got involved in the national campaign against the movie the committee made, a mendacious movie called Operation Abolition. And then started working for Pacifica Radio, KPFA. And that was a turning point in my life. I became active in union activities representing registered nurses and ultimately became a labor neutral arbitrator and mediator.
Well, I guess the upshot of all this, we got a couple minutes left. I remember the we had three lawyers, Charles Gary and Vincent Hallinan and Robert Truhaft. And so we had meetings, and I think it was up to us to decide, did we want to fight this case in court, or whether or were we willing to sort of plead guilty to a very minor charge and just be released? And I think my recollection was Charles Gary wanted to fight it out, and Hallinan and Truhaft thought it was okay just to cop a plea and get it over with. Anyway, that's what people voted to do, and so we pleaded guilty to some.
No. We submitted the case on the police reports, and Judge Axelrod dismissed charges against all 63 of us. On the Meissenbach case, the felony, he had five felony charges against him. They offered him a plea on one, no jail time. But he refused that and went to trial because he felt that if he had entered a plea of guilty, it would have been used to confirm the false reports about what we did. And so I give him an awful lot of credit. He faced jail time.
Well, I think our show is over now. This has been a little bit of history. 50 years ago this month, this all happened. I might quickly add that two of the chairmen of that committee, one was J. Parnell Thomas, wound up going to prison for corruption. And the one who was chairman at that time was Francis Walter from Pennsylvania. And I just found out that during the war, he had presented President Roosevelt with a letter opener made from the arm bone of a dead Japanese soldier. So very interesting. So we've been talking with Burton White about the San Francisco City Hall uprising of 50 years ago. And this has been a little bit of history from Fight the Empire. Stay tuned to KBOO, your radio.